Thank you for downloading Business Matters live on the BBC World Service 5 days a week at 8 a.m. Singapore time and 8 p.m. New York time.
It's midnight GMT. Hello, I'm Roger Hearing, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. We're connecting the time zones. Today we're live in Singapore and New York. Coming up...
Monsieur Macron.
Mr. Macron is the candidate of savage globalisation, social brutality, the fight of everyone against everyone.
C'est de savoir s'ils veulent.
What we're asking our citizens is, do they want your spirit of defeat? Because that's what you bring.
Accusations of defeatism and of elitism, as France's two final candidates for the presidency have a live TV debate. Also, tough new rules on immigration into Australia cause problems in India. And another day of protests in Venezuela as the president outlines a plan for a new assembly to write a new constitution. That's Business Matters here on the BBC, coming up after the latest BBC News.
This is the BBC News. Hello, I'm Jonathan Izard. 4 days before France goes to the polls, the two remaining candidates for the French presidency have attacked each other's policies and characters in a compelling but bad-tempered televised debate. The National Front's Marine Le Pen tried to paint the centrist Emmanuel Macron as being the candidate of the elite. He ridiculed Ms. Le Pen's economic programme. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield was watching.
Marine Le Pen, who lags badly in the opinion polls, had clearly decided that the best tactic was to launch a full frontal attack on Emmanuel Macron. Constantly throughout the debate, she threw insults and allegations at him, accusing him of being part of the discredited existing order. But there was little substance to her attacks, and again, Emmanuel Macron was able to expose the weaknesses in her arguments, especially over the economy and the euro. Afterwards, instant polling by French TV companies suggested that around two-thirds of those who'd watched believed that Emmanuel Macron had been the more convincing. Certainly, the debate will have done nothing to alter his position as clear favourite in Sunday's vote.
The US House of Representatives has scheduled a vote for Thursday to repeal Barack Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. Republicans are now confident they have the numbers to carry the day. Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader, said that significant progress had been made towards enacting one of President Trump's campaign pledges. Protesters have again clashed with riot police in chaotic scenes in cities across Venezuela, with one death being reported. Masked youths in Caracas hurled rocks and firebombs as they headed a march of thousands towards the National Assembly. Candice Piet reports.
Police with riot trucks fired tear gas and rubber bullets on Caracas's main thoroughfare. Water cannon were used to push back a crowd of thousands, some of whom threw stones and petrol bombs. The leaders of the protest march say heavy-handed policing was designed to try and scare them into stopping their demonstrations. They're protesting against President Nicolas Maduro's creation of a new assembly with powers to rewrite the constitution, which they say will be used to avoid free elections. Mr. Maduro has said it will allow the country's opposing factions to begin a new dialogue.
The British Prime Minister Theresa May has accused some politicians and officials in Brussels of not wanting Brexit talks to succeed or Britain to prosper. Here's Norman Smith.
Far from seeking to repair strained relations with EU officials, Theresa May today went on the offensive with a very public and dramatic onslaught against those she dubbed the bureaucrats of Brussels. Mrs. May accused them of seeking to influence the outcome of the general election by misrepresenting her negotiating position. Some, she said, had sought to threaten Britain and did not want the UK to prosper outside the European Union.
The leader of the opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, accused the Prime Minister of playing party games with Brexit. This is the world news from the BBC. Rescue workers in Iran have recovered 21 bodies after a huge explosion at a coal mine which left another 69 people injured. The blast, thought to have been caused by a gas leak, happened at the Zemestan Yurt mine in the northern province of Gulistan. Some of the bodies belong to those who went into the mine to help the injured. Another 32 miners are still trapped underground. One person has been killed and nine peacekeepers wounded after a United Nations camp in Mali came under attack. The UN mission said its camp in the troubled city of Timbuktu was shelled and fired on with rockets. Four of the nine peacekeepers wounded are in a serious condition. At a meeting with the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas at the White House, President Trump has said he's committed to working with Palestinians and Israel to reach a peace deal. It was Mr. Trump's first face-to-face meeting with Mr. Abbas.
The Palestinians and Israelis must work together to reach an agreement that allows both peoples to live, worship, and thrive and prosper in peace. And I will do whatever is necessary to facilitate the agreement, to mediate, to arbitrate, anything they'd like to do, and we will get this done.
The Palestinian president said that a peace accord based on a two-state solution would help the fight against terrorism. Palestinian officials say they've been reassured by one of Mr. Trump's envoys that he is serious about a deal. The talks come 2.5 months after Mr. Trump hosted the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. The Brazilian Justice Minister has defended the government's policy towards indigenous people after an attack on the Gamela people left 13 wounded. Osmar Serralho said the incident was being investigated and stressed that he wanted to speed up the demarcation of indigenous lands to stop invasions by farmers, loggers and illegal miners. Brazil's Indian agency, FUNAI, which is responsible for land allocation, says it has lost almost 50% of its budget in government austerity cuts. BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Roger Hearing. Coming up on the programme today, the two people who could be France's new president debate live on French TV and it gets pretty fierce. Also, reaction from India to new rules on skilled workers moving to Australia and hostile reaction on the streets of Caracas as Venezuela's president announces plans to rewrite the constitution.
We can see police tear gassing, and we can see some protesters throwing Molotov cocktails too, and stones to the police. So very, very violent scenes.
And I'll be joined throughout the programme by two guests on opposite sides of the Pacific, Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts and founder of Democracy at Work, who's joining us from New York, and Tony Nash, Chief Economist at Complete Intelligence, who's joining us from Singapore. Tony, I'll say good morning to you.
Good morning, Roger.
Welcome to the programme once again. And Richard, over the other side of the world, a very good evening to you.
Thank you very much, and the same to you.
And good to have you both with us. Well, let's start with France, because on Sunday, the people in that country are going to head to the polls to elect their new president. They face a simple choice, either the liberal centrist and former economy minister Emmanuel Macron, or, on the far right, the anti-immigration National Front candidate Marine Le Pen. And in the last few hours, the two have been debating vigorously live on French television. Mrs. Le Pen accused Mr. Macron of being an elitist.
Le choix politique que les Français vont devoir faire, c'est clair. Monsieur Macron.
The political choice the French people have is clear. Mr. Macron is the candidate of savage globalization, neoliberalism, social brutality, the fight of everyone against everyone, the dismantling of the economy, particularly the destruction of our big companies, the dismantling of France by big economic interests, and all that with Mr. Hollande pulling the strings.
Hollande, qui est à la manœuvre maintenant de la manière la plus claire qui soit.
Well, for his part, Monsieur Macron accused Mrs. Le Pen of showing a spirit of defeat.
La question qui est posée aujourd'hui à nos concitoyens, c'est de savoir s'ils veulent.
What we're asking our citizens is, do they want your spirit of defeat? Because that's what you bring. What you're saying is that globalization is too difficult for us, Europe is too difficult for us, and we should just fold up, close our borders, get out of the euro, get out of Europe. You are also defeated by terrorism. All democratic countries have to deal with that struggle. I represent the spirit of conquest.
Moi, je porte l'esprit de conquête français.
Well, amongst those watching this debate was Alberto Alemano, professor at the HEC Business School in Paris. I asked him if he thought this was a true clash of fiercely opposed politics and ideas.
You're certainly right that the tones and the language used were somehow unprecedented in the French political landscape. I think Macron talked policy, Le Pen talks Macron. As a result, she was easier to understand her than to understand him. He accepted to engage with some of the basic principles governing several of the challenges facing France, and therefore appear perhaps more sophisticated. So it was probably a draw between the two candidates tonight. Le Pen skillfully escaped the policy debate on the issues she knew perhaps the least, and Macron highlighted her weaknesses all along the debate, but perhaps was less successful in making a case for his own economic vision, to reassure the losers of the economic model he's defending and perhaps promoting in France.
Yeah, there was one very interesting line, I thought, from Mrs. Le Pen, saying that France would be led by a woman. If it wasn't her, then it would be Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor. So she's making the case, really, that Macron is going to lead them into a kind of loss of French sovereignty.
Certainly, this line of argument has been used during the campaign. On this point, I think that Macron was not necessarily credible when he defended the European Union. He certainly has an emotional attachment to it, but he was not necessarily capable of countering how he would defend the French interest within the European Union, per se. Perhaps because, from a generational perspective, he feels really European, and he believes that in Brussels it is possible to identify the European interest rather than the national interest.
The subject of fear came up a lot, including fear, obviously, of Islamist attacks, and Mrs. Le Pen attacked Monsieur Macron's commitment to fighting that. But he called her the high priestess of fear, talking about fear of outsiders, I suppose. Do you think he got the better of that?
Difficult to say. On this point, I think we witness a real fierce debate between the two candidates. Perhaps when talking about safety and anti-terrorist measure, Le Pen accepted, probably the only time in the whole debate, to discuss about the merits of the policies she had in mind. So she somehow put forward an ideal of society that was not necessarily present when discussing the different points. But I think overall, some of the sloppiness or blurriness in presenting those views were caught by Macron, and this helped Macron to somehow look credible, because he clearly mastered both the geopolitics which are surrounding those issues better than Marine Le Pen.
How important is a debate like this, do you think, for making people's mind up as far as which way they will vote on Sunday?
Well, given the current circumstances, I think this debate will play a crucial role. There are a significant number of French voters who are still undecided, especially those who voted on the one hand Mélenchon and Fillon. And those who are undecided tonight were certainly paid attention, and they try to understand who is the candidate better embodies their own ideas and their own worldviews.
Alberto Alemano there. Richard, let me bring you on this, because one the question I asked at the end there, I think, is an interesting one. We get quite, obviously, as journalists, quite excited about these TV debates, but you have them in the States, of course, as well. Do you think they actually make much difference to the way people vote?
I think mainly they serve as a kind of reminder to what people already believe, and that unless there's some shocking, surprising, unexpected development, that my answer would have to be no. I think that, in fact, the biggest response I expect from the French people and from those that I know, and this is I've already gotten, is basically that listening to these two candidates reminded large numbers of French people why they cannot and will not vote for either one of these people.
Not vote at all.
That's right. They will do what's called spoiling your ballot, or effectively choosing not to vote. They agree that Macron is a creature of Hollande, a traditional establishment, down the road, do what we've been doing, only more of it. And they don't want that, as most French people don't. And likewise, they look at Marine Le Pen and they say, this is a scapegoat artist who's trying to get everybody to be revved up about French nationalism and to hate immigrants. We see that in many parts of the world. That's not an answer. That's a visceral reaction that isn't going to solve any of the basic problems. And so you walk away from that saying, I'm not going to vote for either of these people, nor will I be forced into imagining that the only choice is one of them.
That's interesting. Well, of course, in the end, it is, I suppose, apart from the fact that people can abstain. Well, Tony, let me bring you on this. I mean, first of all, that question again. Do you think it makes any difference? I mean, have you personally ever been affected in your vote by seeing a TV debate like this?
I have, actually, but not a last-minute one. I think early on, let's say midway through elections, is where I will pay the most attention. I think with this specific election in France, looking at kind of social media activity is really important. And it seems that it's not as clear cut when you look at the social media activity, and especially when you look at the swing provinces in France. It's a bit closer than it seems to be. I'm not saying that Le Pen is going to win, but I think, the last-minute television appearances like this can, especially comments about Merkel and France being led by a woman in any case, these sorts of things, I think those moments stick with people. And especially with as emotive as Brexit and other EU issues are, those can be kind of money statements from people.
And they may actually make the difference. Well, we'll see. Certainly the markets seem quite spooked by the thought of a potential Le Pen presidency, but we will find out all about that, of course, on Sunday. Anyway, let's find out all about the latest headlines right now with Jonathan Izard.
Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen have traded accusations and insults in a televised debate ahead of Sunday's French presidential election. The National Front's Marine Le Pen tried to paint the centrist Emmanuel Macron as being the candidate of the elite, offering little in the way of reform. Mr. Macron ridiculed Ms. Le Pen's economic programme. A vote will be held in the US Congress on Thursday to repeal Barack Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. After months of political wrangling, Republicans are confident they have won over doubters. And at least one person has been killed in anti-government protests in Venezuela, sparked by President Maduro's decision to form a new constituent assembly. His opponents say it's a ploy to sideline the Congress.
Jonathan, thanks. Now, Australia has announced sweeping changes to its visa rules, making immigration much harder for skilled workers from overseas. It said the move was aimed at prioritising hiring Australians. The highest proportion of skilled workers in Australia are from India. So, how has the move gone down there? Sanjoy Majumdar has been finding out.
Hello, this is Primus. How can I help you?
The offices of Primus are located on the top floor of a residential building in a densely populated Delhi neighbourhood. It's an immigration agency which helps people migrate to Australia and was set up by Poonam Sharma, who is qualified in Australian immigration law. Today, she's being visited by Aditi Goplani.
Last 2 years, we have been very focused in going to Australia. We started with our skill assessment. We paid around $2,500 to $3,000. Now that the time that I've completed all the requirements, suddenly I get to know that everything's just over.
Aditi has just found out that her dream of migrating to Australia has been shattered after a change in the country's immigration laws. She spent the last year taking classes, preparing documents, and acquiring extra skills to plan for her move.
We spoke to our families that we are finally going, and suddenly something of this was unexpected. They should decide that whether it is right for somebody who has actually invested big time in this process. And I would really want them to peek into our lives that it has actually stopped because something was not achieved.
Under the new visa rules, Australia has made it much harder for skilled workers to migrate to that country. Poonam Sharma says the sudden decision has hurt a lot of people.
They have removed 200 occupations on the skilled list. With immediate effect, that means people who were in the pipeline, whose cases were being processed, they suddenly can't go ahead any longer. So there were people who had their assessment, who were studying for English, and they have spent time, money, energy and hopes, but they can't go ahead any longer.
This is how you have to frame things and speak. Okay?
But it's not just workers who are affected. More than 30,000 Indians study in Australian schools and universities.
Say, for example, if you're talking about Lodi Garden, you would be...
Inside a tiny classroom, there are a group of young men and women being taught a lesson in spoken English. The classroom itself is in the basement of a commercial building in one of Delhi's busy markets.
We have a good number of students. We train more than 150, 200 students a month.
Sanchit Gupta runs this institute, Learning Guru.
See, Australia has always excited students, okay? Recently, we have seen that more queries for Australia, mainly because of one reason that US is rejecting visa and Trump is more strict on in visa terms. Okay, so students, they are migrating and they're considering, the ones who were not considering Australia earlier and want to go to US only, now they are asking about Australia also. Okay, what are the possibilities if you go there for further education and job prospects and everything.
But with the new rules, they are worried.
Surely it will affect me and most of the students in future, because if they are changing the rules, they're giving the jobs to Australian, not the Indians.
Australia was always seen in India as a country that openly welcomed immigrants. Now it's the latest in a long line of countries to tighten immigration rules. It means that for many Indians looking to go overseas to secure their future, options are running out.
Sanjoy Majumda. Tony, I mean, America for Americans, Australia for Australians. Is the world shrinking, do you think, in that sort of way?
Well, I don't think the world is shrinking, but I think more scrutiny is being put, of course, on kind of these skilled workers. You know, there are something like 96,000 people in Australia on these visas, and there are something like 250,000 in the U.S. on H-1Bs. It might actually be more than that. But you know, there are a lot of people sitting on the sidelines. I don't know about Australia, but in the U.S., there are a number of people sitting on the sidelines. And I think there is a real, question about whether these temporary visas are adding to the workforce skills in the U.S., right? So I live in a place where there are a lot of foreign workers, okay, in Singapore. And Singapore changed its laws 4 years ago to give preference to Singaporeans in hiring. And the skills and developing skills in Singapore for management and technical skills and these sorts of things, the government's really focused on this. So I guess if we take it out of, say, the U.S. or Australia and put it on a place like Singapore, you know, this place is really focused on getting good jobs for Singaporeans.
And that depends on keeping other people out, is what you're saying.
It does, until those skills are up and until that demand is down, or until that demand comes back. And I think until we start to see a vibrant, growing global economy again, it's really hard to justify these types of kind of waves of skilled immigrants coming in. There are also issues, Roger, around whether or not those immigrants on those visas are getting the salaries that are actually declared on those visas. That's a technical issue, but it's one that's caused real concern in places like the U.S.
Okay, well, let's go to the U.S. Richard, I mean, the point, I suppose, is there is that reflection certainly you have an administration in Washington now that's talking far more about keeping skilled jobs in America, making Americans skilled to do them. I mean, do you see it as a global trend?
Yes, I'm afraid I do, although as an economist, I must tell you, I don't see this as a problem of labor or of work. There's plenty of work that could and should be done. There really are plenty of jobs needed to perform that work, but we live in an economic system that isn't governed by the rationality of the work that needs to be done and the jobs that are there to do it. We live in a system in which it's only going to be a job if it's profitable to someone to employ you, and the profit calculations are such that there aren't enough jobs to go around. And then we really can't be surprised as people come to grips with the fact that there aren't enough jobs to go around and begin casting around for a standard, a rationale by which to decide who gets the scarce jobs and who doesn't.
But does it then make sense to give those jobs to American workers if the jobs are in America?
Well, it depends on what you mean by making sense. You know, this is a country that prides itself, or says it does, on a history of accepting immigrants, of wanting that kind of diversity, of shaking up the old traditions in a productive progressive way. If you shut yourself down, then either you weren't telling the truth about your history as a welcoming place for immigrants, or suddenly you've reevaluated what immigrants do perform. For me, what ought to be done is to do the things that are necessary to provide the jobs for both the immigrants and the domestic people, rather than throwing them at each other, at each other's throats, and producing the kind of ugly, bad feelings that are spreading in our country as this anti-immigration wave crests across our culture.
And we can hear that clearly in India, that there's resentment right. as well of the effect there. Okay, well, let's move now on to somewhere where the economy is having enormous problems for all sorts of reasons. I'm talking about Venezuela. And Venezuela has again been in turmoil. Masked youths clashed with riot police on Wednesday, who used tear gas and rubber bullets in the streets of the capital, Caracas. and at least one demonstrator was killed on Wednesday. The protests have been going on for more than a month now, but the latest anger is over a plan by President Nicolas Maduro to form a constituent assembly as a counterweight to the elected National Assembly, which is dominated by his opponents. The new assembly, he says, will write a new constitution to break the current political deadlock. His opponents say it's a ruse to get past the democratic system. Meanwhile, the economic crisis is worsening. I've been speaking to the BBC's Daniel Garcia in Caracas.
Yes, at least one person has been killed. It's been, again, a very busy day, another rally against the government, and we've seen some violent scenes today.
What did you yourself see when you were out on the streets?
We see a lot of people, thousands of people, marching against the government. And we can see police tear gassing just to prevent this crowd to go into the city center. And yeah, we can see some protesters throwing Molotov cocktails too and stones to the police. So very, very violent scenes.
And what are people really angry about? Is it this constituent assembly that President Maduro has been talking about?
Well, of course, it hasn't helped to make things easier and to try to put an end to this crisis. But of course, most of people are very angry with the government because of the economic and social crisis, how difficult it is to get some food, medicines and basic goods.
And at the Constituent Assembly, what is his plan? What is the president's plan with this?
Today he had a meeting with the electoral power, but we don't know yet the details about this process. It's still very early. We have to wait to see the details of the process to know how it's going to be worked, how it's going to be the situation, and how is the process to elect the people who will be part of this assembly.
The idea is they're going to write a new constitution. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. But some people in the government are talking about it just to renew the old constitution. So it's still not clear if it's going to be a brand new constitution or just a modified one.
And what about the next few weeks or months? Are these demonstrations, do you think, going to continue? Will they bring down the government in the end?
Well, it's very difficult. It's hard to predict. So we saw a very similar situation 3 years ago, and at the end, nothing happened. So in the end, nothing happened. So it's very hard to predict. So the protesters are very determined to carry on with this fight. So it seems to me that it can last more weeks.
Daniel Garcia there in Caracas. Richard, I mean, it's a complicated situation, but clearly at the root of it is huge economic problems.
Yes, I think they are of two kinds. Basically, Venezuela is still living through the consequences of a sustained effort associated with Hugo Chavez to fundamentally alter the economic and political system of Venezuela. He made that clear. He tried to organize mass assemblies of poor people, largely excluded from politics for a long time. Those people have now expectations. They've gotten used to it. They don't want to give up an opportunity. And then there are the people who were sidelined by all of this, the conventional folks who run places like Venezuela and who are up in arms. And in the midst of this kind of fundamental struggle about a socialist or a non-socialist future, you have the collapse of oil, which undercuts the entire economic system of a place like Venezuela that is so dependent on that particular product. So you put all that together and you have an explosive combination. But I don't think we should lose sight of the more underlying historical conflict, because that's what's going to determine the outcome more than the day-to-day upsets in the streets.
We will see how that all plays out, but it's a fascinating and worrying situation. Stay with us. Much more coming up here on Business Matters in just a moment. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Roger Hearing, and my guests today, Richard Wolfe and Tony Nash. Now, if you've been shopping in the US, if you've been to New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, you're probably used to those huge and rather amazing department stores. The name Macy's, I suppose, comes into my mind, but there are many others. But there might not be many others for much longer, because the US department store is in an age of decline.
More trouble for Macy's and many other giant retailers.
The parent company of Sears and Kmart is shutting down 150 stores nationwide. The news comes a day after
Macy's is closing 100 of its 650 stores, 15%. That is astonishing for this iconic retailer that used to be a mainstay in America's malls.
Retail is a mess, to say the least. From a 10,000-foot view, this trend, these retailers have had declining top line for a number of years now, and this is not a cyclical issue. The economy's been good, right? Consumer sentiment's good, unemployment's coming down. This is a secular issue. This is a forever trend. If you think about how things are going to look 10 years from now or 20 years from now, our parents will be dead, our kids will be adults. Do you think more people are going to be shopping online or less? Right? This is the Amazon effect, and it's here forever.
Some of the worrying headlines from American Nets on the decline of the department store, a forever trend there. Now, Professor Wolfe, do you agree? Do you concur? Is this are our descendants not going to know what department stores are?
Well, predicting the future is a tough business, to say the least. I don't much believe in it. But I will tell you this, that since 2000, basically these last 17 years have been an unending decline in the number of people working in our department stores, in the number of people going and shopping in the malls that are anchored by these stores. You'd have to be very bizarre in your reading of statistics when you can see a number, for example, that one-third of the people working in department stores in 2000 are no longer working there. That is, we're down to two-thirds of what we once were. This kind of long-term 17-year downward trend means that this is a system, a shopping system, a retail system, in extremis, and it may very well disappear, maybe not all of it, but the basic quality of life in the United States, which has included a department store and the mall as a central feature, that's disappearing, either because of the technology that allows you to buy things from Amazon or other people who will ship it to your home at a lower price than you will have to pay in the department store, or more likely the underlying reason is that the economic crisis of 2008 simply took us over the edge. If there was a chance for these malls to come back and for department stores to survive, that was the end. By squeezing the consumer power of the American mass, it made it impossible to afford. The mall and going to the store became a luxury that you couldn't afford. And so the pressure of your economy and the availability of shipping it to your home with Amazon's new technology simply was too much. And yes, we are therefore witnessing the disappearance, if not 100%, in large part, not just of the economic reality of standalone stores, retail stores, but all that they represented in American culture as the place for teenagers and others to gather at whatever community center many communities in America had, which was that mall, all of that is disappearing, and the social and cultural consequences are heavy indeed and are felt very acutely.
Well, I was going to say,
this is,
you know, I mean, in the images one has of America, of modern America, do often focus certainly around the malls, I guess, and culture that comes from that. But let's internationalize this. Tony, you know, where you are, if you go around in Singapore, do people shop in malls? Do they shop in department stores? Is that still going on?
Yeah, it is. It's as much of a social issue here as it is a commercial issue. So homes in Asia are typically a bit smaller. Shopping malls offer a place for people to get out and socialize and, you know, be in air conditioning if you live in a place like Singapore without running at home, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, you are getting, you know, F&B as well as some shopping in the malls here. You know, I was just in the U.S. I just came back to Singapore on Tuesday morning, and I was in New York and walked by Macy's. It seemed to be pretty quiet. And I met somebody on Friday night who was in a private equity firm focused on retail investment, okay? And I said, "What with the decline of physical shopping spaces in the U.S., why would private equity need to focus on new retail investments?" And the answer was, you know, there is health in retail. There are things and improvements that can be made. But it is, you know, I think when you look at the model of a place like Macy's, they just haven't kept up with the way people shop and the rapid nature of global supply chains. These were some of the first people to, say, order in Asia, you know, this sort of thing, and take advantage of that scale and cost implications. But when you go into these places and you see markdowns of 70% off on a regular basis, it's impossible for them to be profitable if they're marking things down that much. So inventory control, supply chain control, cost control, this sort of thing is a real issue in major U.S. retail.
And also, you know, you talked about what happens in Singapore, but over Asia more widely, is it the same story or is Asia a long way behind America in this?
Generally, but when you look at a place like Japan, look, old people don't shop as much as young people and people in their prime earning years. So, you know, you have a bit of that demographic issue in the U.S. where the shopping malls are in places where people peaked incomes in the 80s and 90s, okay? And in Japan, you have retail issues where people just aren't shopping as much because they're beyond that peak earning year. So the malls themselves, if they could pick up and move to newer suburbs, I'm sure you'd have much more life in them. But they're just not in the right places.
So that's interesting. So what you're saying is that guy you were talking about is right. There is room to invest in retail.
Yeah.
It's worth it. But they have to change the model. Okay, Richard, let me come back to you on this. I mean, you were talking about the mechanisms that have made this and indeed the consequences socially. Do you think it is going to have a profound effect in America? Will it change the way American society? Will it, you know, if people are shopping entirely from their computers, which is what we're kind of thinking of, what effect is that going to have?
Well, it's part of a kind of staggering loneliness that is settling on American culture. If you sit in a train, in a bus, in a subway in the United States today, everyone is individually bent over their smartphone, busily communicating electronically and oblivious of the human being on either side of them. It used to be that one of the few social gathering places was the mall, because we do not fund our public services adequately to create community centers of other kinds. The churches try to do it a little bit, but they're not very successful. The mall was the place where people went. You're now shutting those down. They're becoming hulks, empty hulks with weeds growing through the parking lots in town after town. And I think it's having a devastating effect on removing one of the few socializing community production spaces in American culture and produce a kind of loneliness that can perhaps best be illustrated, it's a bit stark, but by noticing that a growing number of the mass shootings in the United States, which we have so many of compared to other countries, are taking place in malls where people kind of express in the most extreme way imaginable their upset about what's happening to the culture, the explosion of their own upset about an economic system that doesn't seem to speak to them anymore and puts in the way these kinds of obstacles that trouble them.
You're seriously linking shootings to the decline of department stores and malls?
I think it has something to do with it. I think there's a loneliness that is overcoming people and that the mall figures increasingly as the place people go for a kind of last expression of some sort of linkage, however destructive, to a society that feels to them provides no place for them anymore.
It's quite extraordinary. I get what you're saying. I mean, Tony, what do you make of that?
You know what? I don't know how you would link, say, the Kenya Mall shooting last year to this. I mean,
well, that was a very different. That was a thing to do with
Somali. Yeah, but it's just where people, just where there are people and they're not protected. So I don't necessarily draw that stark of a conclusion. But I do think, you know, when you look at, say, online shopping and you look at connectivity, you know, I have more friends today. I've made more friends in places I wouldn't be able to make. I've found more products that I wouldn't be able to find through connections online. So I hear what Professor Wolf is saying about loneliness. I just don't necessarily buy it. And I actually think spanning both the on and offline worlds, finding products online to go to a physical location. If you look at what Amazon's doing with shopping and other things, you know, they're finding out how to successfully draw people in through an online experience and then conclude that with an offline experience.
Yeah, they're actually building physical shops, aren't they?
Exactly.
That is.
And so this seems to be a way to not completely, I don't believe we're not going to have any store locations. It just doesn't seem realistic to me.
Okay.
So I think this thing spans both worlds, and I think increasingly you're seeing people willing to do that.
Okay, Richard, let me pay that back on you and say that was a point that was coming to my mind, which is that people are perhaps not as lonely as you think they are because the connections they make are online, where you can have a strong connection with people. Young people do it all the time.
Right, but they also complain about feeling lonelier than they ever have. And these are electronically mediated connections that have none of the immediacy and the multi-level interaction that a face-to-face.
Well, you can talk on Skype. You can talk you can see
yes.
people. You can talk to them in all around the world. I mean, okay, you're not touching them necessarily, but you're doing everything.
And
but
you're having all the interference that a Skype connection or that kind of connection.
Some are better than
has.
Others. Yeah.
But let me give an example of what's been told to me in many, many malls. That more and more people come to the mall. They go through the aisles. They look at the objects because they really do want to be in that social situation. They do want to touch and look at the object. They don't really like the absolute electronic distances that are now required. And then they sit there with their smartphone, having looked at what the store has to offer. They then check to see whether Amazon or some other big distributor can get it to them more cheaply, and then the disgruntled department store manager explains, we pay for the air conditioning, we pay for the lighting, we store all the equipment, we keep the inventory, and they come here, take advantage of all we've done, and then buy it on Amazon because they can save $5. This is the end of our business.
I've certainly heard that being said.
Yeah, and it's a very serious problem, and you hear it everywhere here.
Well, there we are. The death of the mall and the department store in America and potentially extreme consequences. Right, let's bring ourselves right up to date with the latest Business Matters headlines with Jonathan Izard.
The two remaining candidates for the French presidency have attacked each other's policies and characters in a compelling but bad-tempered televised debate. The National Front's Marine Le Pen tried to paint the centrist Emmanuel Macron as being the candidate of the elite. Mr. Macron accused his opponent of showing a spirit of defeat. Opposition protesters have clashed with riot police in cities across Venezuela. A teenage protester died in Caracas as police used rubber bullets and water cannon. The latest anger is fueled by President Nicolas Maduro's recent decree that creates a 500-member constituent body to rewrite the constitution. And Facebook's profits surged in the first 3 months of the year, according to its latest earnings results. The US tech giant said profits increased 76% year on year to just over $3 billion in that period. The number of people using Facebook on a monthly basis has increased to 1.94 billion. That's higher than experts had predicted. And on the financial markets, the Dow Jones ended the day up less than 0.1% at 20,957.
Jonathan, thanks. Now it's that moment in the programme where we link up with one of our reporters. Today it's Juliana Liu, joining us live on the line from Hong Kong. So Juliana, what's the big story where you are today?
Well, one of the stories that I'm watching is that China is to launch an online version of its own encyclopedia to compete with Wikipedia. Apparently, 20,000 people have been hired for this project. And when it finishes, it'll have around 300,000 entries of around 1,000 words each. Now, very differently from Wikipedia, apparently, this encyclopedia will be written by paid academics. So at the moment, Wikipedia is largely available in China, but some entries are blocked. For example, some terms, I'm sure, such as
Tiananmen Square. Perhaps. Yeah, I was going to say.
You would imagine Dalai Lama, Xi Jinping, you know, you can imagine the list. And the man in charge of this encyclopedia has been quoted as saying that the aim is to overtake Wikipedia. Still uncertain to me at the moment how much appeal it will have for those outside China. Roger, do you use Wikipedia?
I do. I can imagine the one in China, presumably, would be subject to government control of a fairly strict kind.
The usual controls on what is allowed and what isn't. Mm. And it may also have a different cultural slant in terms of, so not just the subjects that are allowed or not allowed, but the way in which they're written. And some academics have suggested that this may be popular with some of its readers, of course, inside China.
Well, we'll see. But I suppose one way people might access it is through their iPad, potentially, if they've got one, because Apple's sales performance in China, how are they doing in selling these kind of goods to China at the moment?
That's right. So Apple has just released its quarterly revenues, profit figures for the last quarter. And very importantly, Apple China revenues seem to have fallen 14% to just under $11 billion. More worryingly, on a quarterly basis, it seems to have fallen by 34%. Now, China is the world's largest smartphone market, so this is very key for people investing in Apple. The CEO of Apple has said that he's still very enthusiastic about what's happening in China, and they will have some new models being pushed out later this year, so that may help. But there is a lot of competition from the likes of Oppo and Vivo. These are homegrown smartphone makers. And the reason they're doing so well is because these phones are much cheaper than a proper Apple phone. But they have a lot of the same functionality. And in terms of apps, China's increasingly being dominated by the app economy, by apps like WeChat that seem to do everything. So these apps, which can be available on almost any smartphone, is what driving kind of the usage of phones. And in China, in the Chinese context, it seems the model of the phone itself seems to be less important. This is really ironic because, the Apple iPhone launched in 2007. That's what gave rise to the Apple, to the app economy in the first place. So it's a bit ironic that it seems to be in some ways working against it now, at least in China.
Well, moving from tech finally to something a bit more natural. There's been a lot of news, of course, about deforestation in China, people chopping down trees for all kinds of reasons. But I gather there's an element of putting trees back. Is that going on at the moment?
Yes, this is a really interesting story. It's a story from the New York Times. So over the last 10 years, China has spent more than $100 billion to plant new forests. This is a very lauded project. Chinese officials are very proud of it, and it's something the country has consistently said they're very proud of. But according to a new study from the Proceedings of Royal Society B, the success seems to have been overstated, that in fact some of the forests that were supposedly planted were not quite forests, but shrubs.
Oh, not quite the same.
So the study was done using high-resolution photos. And the main reason seems to be the question, quite a philosophical question, perhaps something that you would find particularly perhaps in certain cultures, like Japanese cultures, like what is a forest? What is a forest, Roger?
Well, a forest is a lot of trees, I think, probably.
Yes,
something a bit bigger than a wood.
10% tree cover or 30% tree cover? Now, we can quibble over those definitions, but it seems like, what's been planted have been shrubs, not necessarily full-on forests. I guess my question is, will these shrubs eventually grow to become forests?
Ah, yes. From little acorns do mighty oaks grow, I guess, is the answer there. Okay, Juliana, thanks very much indeed for that. Juliana Liu there, live on the line from Hong Kong. Now, I want you to do something. I want you to lean back, if you can, and close your eyes and just set your imagination running. Okay, what are you thinking? What are you seeing? Dusty old building in the desert, perhaps? Now, of course, it's Hotel California, the mega hit by the Eagles from the 1970s, but is it about a particular real hotel? Well, the band say no. And they're not best pleased that a hotel in Baja California, Mexico, is reportedly claiming to be the real Hotel California. The Eagles, in fact, are seeking a legal injunction now to stop them, as I heard from David Willis in Los Angeles.
They were, of course, one of the most successful bands of the 1970s, and they filed a lawsuit here in Los Angeles accusing the owners of a Mexican hotel of using the name Hotel California without their permission. Now, this lawsuit claims that the hotel owners encourage guests to believe that the place inspired the lyrics of that famous song, and as well as piping Eagles music through the sound system at the hotel and calling the place the legendary Hotel California, they sell t-shirts and mugs and keychains and other merchandise off the back of that. So the Eagles are looking to stop all that, and they want damages. No word, Roger, I might add, on whether this place holds dances in the courtyard or whether any of the staff members are affected with the Mercedes-Benz.
Well, indeed, yes. And, you know, can you check out but you can never leave? That would be somewhat unfortunate. I suppose the point in all this is that this is a famous name. And I think if I've read the story right, the hotel is called the Hotel California and was right back to the 1950s.
It was, yes. It was named Hotel California when it opened in 1950. I mean, that's about 25 years before the Eagles wrote that song. And it went through several name changes before being rechristened the Hotel California in 2001. Now, the hotel's website makes the point that the Eagles never owned the place, but it does note similarities that it says they share with the lyrics of the song, including the long highway that leads to the entrance. Remember the words, on a dark desert highway, a cool wind in my hair?
Absolutely.
And it also mentions the Mission Church of Pilar, which is right next door. I heard the mission bell, and so on.
So in fact, maybe they have a case, but I think if I remember the album cover, and I could dig it out from my enormous collection, as I'm sure you have, the hotel on the front isn't that hotel, is it?
It isn't. And according to one of their founders, Don Henley, the song Hotel California has nothing to do with California and nothing to do with a hotel. It's all about coming of age, a journey from innocence to experience. But they're wacky lyrics, of course, and they've been analysed and scrutinised by Eagles fans for years.
And now they'll be looked at even more closely to see, I guess, in the courts as to whether or not this is a case. I mean, it could be, presumably, many millions of dollars involved in this.
Well, it could be. And this is a band which is not shy, Roger, when it comes to defending intellectual property. A few years ago, its lawyers filed another lawsuit, a trademark infringement lawsuit, against the American Eagle Foundation. Now, that's a non-profit organisation that was set up to defend the bald eagle and other endangered birds of prey. That lawsuit, I might add, was later dropped. They've also sued other places that call themselves the Hotel California. I'm not sure, actually, why anybody would want to stay at the Hotel California of the song. There are all those people dancing in the courtyard, and you've just got pink champagne there, and you could check out simply enough, but leaving is a real pain.
David Willis, perhaps he's just a prisoner of his own device, if we're going to go and quote lyrics all over the place. Tony, it does seem, to quote something else, as breaking a butterfly upon a wheel. I mean, does it really matter that somewhere calls itself Hotel California and people like to go there?
No.
Would you go there?
I don't know. It depends on how tough it would be to get there, but I really don't care. I mean, look, the song is 40 years old, so, you know, if it was brand new and somebody changed the name of their hotel to the song name, like, right now, sure, that's maybe pursue it, but it's 40 years ago. This is, I don't know.
Doesn't really matter.
No,
it's easy. Richard, what do you make of it?
I love the song. I love the group. I love the haunting melody. So for me, anything that brings it back into circulation is a good thing. So I hope there's lots of hoop-de-doodle about this and more people will listen to the music.
Well, the hoop-de-doodle might be going on in the hotel, and I suppose the Eagles object to the fact that these people, in their view, are using a name and their property. I mean, like, there is a property right in this, I guess, Richard. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a property right that they ought to be respected for what they've accomplished. On the other hand, I do agree with the other guest you have that 40 years is a pretty long time. You've had your property rights. You've gotten your gains out of it. Now let it be part of the public's awareness, of the public culture. that would be the more democratic way to proceed. I like that one better.
Well, and I suppose, Tony, I mean, there is actually a sort of statute of limitations on these kind of rights anyway, isn't it? I think 50 years or depends which country you're in.
Yes, and I don't know what it is.
No, but we don't. But I mean, but do you think, you know, you think that I suppose people might still think, even 40 years on, you know, we wrote this blessed thing. Surely we have the rights to it all. You can't just take those rights off us.
Look, I agree with Dr. Wolf. It's about publicity, I think, more than anything.
Yeah,
maybe they get some money out of it. But come on, I mean, yeah, it's about publicity.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it is publicity, Richard. In the end, you know, they're suing in a way something that's actually probably helping their album sales.
Yes, it gets it more circulated. It's a little venal to proceed in this way. Why not be broad-minded and give a gesture and say, look, we renounce all these things here. We've done real well. We've earned a lot of money. This is something that everybody should be able to enjoy in whatever way is consistent with the spirit of the music we made.
Yeah, because really, the music does tend to talk about things, you know.
Absolutely.
Spirit since 19... We haven't had that spirit here since 1969, you know. Right. I mean, it's free and easy. And, well, maybe it makes the best way to play out of this edition of Business Matters because we're in a free and easy mood. My thanks to Richard, my thanks to Tony, my thanks to all of you for listening. And you can check out and you can leave, but come back tomorrow.
If you enjoyed Business Matters and would like an even bigger daily diet of business, why not subscribe to World Business Report? It's half an hour of the latest business, economic and finance news, now available late afternoon in Europe and Africa.